From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We begin this hour with a conversation with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. She is a Democrat running for re-election this year. We have invited her opponent to join us. We have not heard back. We hope we can make that conversation happen. This conversation is a pre-recorded one. Matching up schedules can be a challenge, and today, instead of having the senator on live, we had to record the conversation you're about to hear. We spoke to her within the last hour. With that, we welcome back to the program Senator Kirsten Gillibrand.
My pleasure.
Was there any consideration on your part to not running for re-election? You're running for re-election this year. Was there any consideration to not running? Washington isn't the most polite place. It's a pretty rancorous place right now. Did you think about other options?
No, I didn't. First of all, I love serving the people of New York State. But I also feel like I'm making a difference where I am. I've been able to bring to fruition a lot of the pieces of legislation I've been working on for some 2 years, some 5 years, some 10 years in the last few years, and it's made a huge difference. We were able to get health care for 3.5 million veterans who were exposed to burn pits while serving during the war on terror, horrible, you know, diseases, cancers caused by those toxins. We just got our big gun trafficking bill done. I was one of the first bills I wrote when I became a senator in 2009, and we paired it with a great deal of money for mental health. We've already gotten about $100 million of mental health money into New York State to deal with all the challenges we have post-COVID. And we've arrested nationwide over 300 traffickers, and we've confiscated nearly 3,000 weapons. So it's working slowly but surely. And I've been doing a lot on workplace reforms. I'm working on a bill right now to stop age discrimination at the workplace. Last year, we got a bill done to stop how we deal with sexual harassment and assault in the workplace and allow people now to sue in a court of law and not have to do mandatory arbitration and not have to sign non-disclosure agreements. That changed 60 million employment contracts overnight. And so we're trying to do the same thing with age discrimination this year. So I decided I wanted to run for re-election because I thought I could continue to help people and tackle tough problems that nobody was tackling. And I've been able to work on a bipartisan basis really consistently my entire 14 years in the Senate. And I want to keep doing that to deliver real results and help for people who need it.
We're going to talk about some of those bills in particular coming up here in just a moment. Let me kind of bring the lens out a little wider and talk foreign policy first, and then we'll come back to domestic affairs. But let me just start with the fact that the last time you and I spoke, you said that, yes, there are some rather loud Republicans who opposed funding, for example, for Ukraine in defense of itself. But for the most part, it was still a bipartisan effort to support Ukraine. It took a long time to get the latest round of support and funding for Ukraine. How do you see that issue right now? And do you think it is still as strongly bipartisan as you hope it is?
I do. I, in fact, just traveled to meet with our new NATO allies with a group of Republican senators to talk about how Finland and how Sweden can help in this war against Russia and what they can bring to bear as NATO allies and what their concerns are. This is a long-term battle, and standing up to Russia is essential because if they are allowed to succeed in Ukraine, they will likely invade Moldova. They will then go to Poland, and they will continue to wreak havoc across Europe. It also, unfortunately, is something that China is looking at and watching. And if China sees us decide we don't care about authoritarian regimes invading other countries, well, they might choose to invade Taiwan. And, you know, Taiwan's been a democracy and an ally for a long time. We have a one China policy. We believe in one China as a national security perspective, but we've always supported Taiwan as a democracy and as a thriving place in its own right. And so it's important that we not cower to bullies. It's important that we not give up long fights. And I think the Republican senators that certainly I traveled with and the ones that I talk to regularly are committed to that fight.
Can you give me a sense for what you think the end goal should be for Ukraine? And I understand the idea that if Russia subsumes Ukraine, that it could be looking at future targets. But Ukraine is not part of NATO. You mentioned Poland. You bring up Russia possibly knowing that it would be attacking a NATO state? And why would you think that Russia would do that given it hasn't yet?
Largely because that is what President Putin has said. He wants to reconstitute the former Soviet Union. He wants to take back Estonia and all the Baltics. He has said that this is his empire. He's entirely focused on empire. And while that's quite delusional, in my assessment, it is something that is part of his ambition. So I think we need to take these leaders at their word. I think the world was very much on its heels before the invasion. I think people assumed we were post-conflict. I think in Europe specifically, the corporations were the new oligarchs. The people who cared about a strong economy had more power than the people who cared about a strong national security. And as a consequence, they bought all their fuel from Russia. They allowed China to build their 5G with no concern for how that would affect their national security long term, because they just didn't worry about it. Europe has woken up. They now realize these are concerns. It's why Sweden and Finland just joined NATO. They now realize that their independence, they've always been independent, and they've always avoided this coalition because they didn't think they needed it. They believe they need it now. They see Russia's aggression. They're afraid for themselves. I was at the Finnish border, at the border with Russia, and the people who are working there are on alert. They think Russia could decide to invade any moment because they're so empire driven right now. And so that's their assessment, and they live right next to them. So I don't think we should be sanguine at all that Russia doesn't have massive ambition and that China doesn't have massive ambition. We in America have this sense of security that's unique since we have allies north and south of North America. But it's not how the rest of the world sees the world, with these very, very powerful and well-funded authoritarian regimes that have very high ambitions.
Should the United States go to war with China if China invades Taiwan?
So that, unfortunately, would be a world war. And China is now allied with Russia and Iran. So it could be a very devastating world war. So our goals would not be to go to war with China. Our goals would be to support Taiwan to defend themselves in the same way we have supported Ukraine to defend itself. We are continuing to work with our allies to be prepared for such a moment. We've told our allies they should not give China access to their water rights, their rare earth metal rights, their basing opportunities that give them telemetry to satellite control, things that would really harm the United States and other countries from a war by China against an ally or against us. And we have to wake up the world to these threats. They are now aware of them because they're watching what's happened in Ukraine. And they're becoming much more willing to work with us to create the circumstances by which China will choose not to invade. Our goal is to end a war before it starts. And you do that by creating alliances, stronger alliances, partnerships, empower our allies to fight for themselves, make sure people are investing in things that protect themselves. So those are our goals right now, is to prevent that war.
In Israel, President Biden has been obviously a staunch ally of Israel all along and certainly post October 7. But he's also indicated that he is not comfortable with some. He's called some of the siege on Gaza over the top. He's indicated that American support could ebb if the situation in Rafah escalates. Where do you think the American line should be? Should it just be continued unlimited support for Israel?
So my goal is to advise and push an ally such as Israel into a regional alignment with the Arab partners that are available to them. Because the best way to defeat terrorism is to have the alliances that allow you to defeat terrorism. If they really want to defeat Hamas, they're ultimately going to need the help of the Palestinian people. And that is a very different roadmap than the one we are on right now. And I think it's one that is available to Israel if they choose to pivot. If they choose to pivot, they could be signing a regional defense alliance with the Abraham Accord countries, which is UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco. They could be adding Saudi Arabia through normalization with them and then get a recommitment from Jordan and Egypt, who have already done that. And that alliance would be enough to create a plan to both rebuild Gaza, rebuild the Palestinian state, and have a 20-year-long alliance to defeat Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and Iran, because all of those Arab nations are threatened by terrorism and threatened by those terrorist organizations that are being funded by Iran. That is where I think Israel should be going. And I think we are stuck in this debate because Hamas will not agree to a ceasefire. Hamas does not want a two-state solution. Hamas wants Israel to be destroyed. And they are not a reliable negotiating partner in this peace agreement. They're just refusing to agree to anything that is remotely acceptable. And so we need to focus on a different approach. And so I'd be urging Israel to pivot to this regional alliance. And with that, you can create a ceasefire. You can get the hostages returned because you have the Arab allies fighting with you against Hamas and ensuring that Hamas returns those hostages. So I just think we're focused on the wrong thing because we do have to defeat Hamas. But we do need to create a Palestinian state long term that has stability, and we need the help of the Palestinian people.
One other question on that point. We recently spoke to a number of Rochesterians of Palestinian descent, and they told us that their feeling is that both the American media and American politicians are too focused on Hamas, that Hamas is essentially just a political party, that they reject the idea that Hamas is intentionally creating bases of operations in civilian areas, schools, hospitals, et cetera, and that the focus needs to be on the actions and, in their view, the atrocities of Israel. Do you not see it that way?
Sadly, I think those individuals are deeply misinformed. The tunnels underneath hospitals, schools, across all of Gaza were designed to be weapons of war, to be places of operation, to store weapons, to execute military operations. Hamas raped, tortured, murdered 1,200 innocent civilians. They are a terrorist organization. Their statement, their mantra of who is Hamas, says the destruction of Israel and the destruction of all Jews. So they are a hate-filled organization that intends to destroy innocent people as their mandate and as their motto. So unfortunately, we are dealing with the fact that we don't have shared facts right now. I've met with New Yorkers who don't believe October 7th happened. I've met with New Yorkers who share the views that you just articulated. Those aren't truths. Those are falsehoods. Russia is spending a lot of money making sure misinformation, disinformation is streaming into our social media. Unfortunately, Americans are very, well, it's not unfortunately, it's one of our best attributes. We're very open people. We're very trusting people. We're very honest people. And so unfortunately, when you have entities, organizations, countries, individuals that are determined to destroy the United States, many of them are choosing to use disinformation as their number one weapon. And they will seed falsehoods. They will seed disinformation to make people hate each other, to make people disagree about everything, to make people be divided. And I would suggest that those individuals do not have access to facts. Whatever they are seeing, reading, receiving is intentional to mislead them and to make them not see the world as it is.
Senator Gillibrand, obviously, we're in the middle of a presidential campaign. Donald Trump could be president in January. And there's been a lot of talk about how, well, you know, he was president for 4 years. He didn't pull the United States out of NATO. Domestically, he did X, Y, Z. That's a pretty good roadmap. We know what he would do. My sense is that when he got to power in 2016, he was still surrounded by a lot of sort of establishmentarian type Republicans, and that this time around would be very, very different, not just because of who he is, but because of who would be doing a lot of the work around him. How do you see that?
Well, I share many of the concerns you just articulated. We have read that he intends to purge civil servants out of the federal government, people who do these jobs every day to keep the lights on in America, to make sure we have strong transportation policy, to make sure we have strong banking systems, economic policy, to make sure we have clean air, clean water, a food inspection, every type of protection and safety you'd want in the United States. Those are our civil servants, and he wants to have a purge and replace it with people who are beholden to him, who may not be trained, who may know nothing, who may have no education on the subject matter with which they have responsibilities. That's very dangerous. He has continued to take aim at women. He wants to take away all of our bodily autonomy, what medicines we can take, whether we can have birth control, whether we can access any types of reproductive care. It's very dangerous, and it's trying to bring America back by hundreds of years and deny women basic civil rights and civil liberties. And so he'll continue the assault on women with his judges and with his viewpoints. He will, unfortunately, put the United States in a much less secure position internationally. He wants to walk away from NATO. He does not want to stand up to Russia. I don't think he wants to stand up to China. I think we'd be in a much less safe place, and I would fear for the stability of our democracy. So, yes, I have very strong concerns about what a Trump presidency would do to the United States and to our democracy. It's also one of the reasons why I'm working so hard to flip the House of Representatives. I've launched a coordinated campaign with Governor Hochul and Hakeem Jeffries. We lost 5 House seats last cycle that were Democratic seats, and we are therefore raising money and organizing. We've hired 30 full-time staff. We have 8 offices opened already. We are organizing students in the 5 districts. We're doing Black and Latino and AAPI outreach to make sure people know how important their voices are and their views are, and how much we want them engaged so that they can vote. And so far, it's making a difference. We had success in helping New York 3, and which is on Long Island. Well, that was a 16-point vote swing. We lost it by 8 points last cycle. We won it by 8 points in the special election. So I'm optimistic that this coordinated campaign can make the difference. We've never had one in New York. And I'm optimistic that as the only person running statewide, that I can work with these candidates to help them get across the finish line.
Let me conclude with you by asking you a little bit more about what you have been working on. You mentioned a little bit about it. I want to talk about the bill that would provide millions of dollars in funding for child care for the police workforce. And this comes at, you know, to me at least, an interesting time politically in that, you know, here in our area, I suspect you've seen the district attorney, Sandra Dorley, video of her went super viral across the country, really internationally, of her refusing to be pulled over by a police officer and then berating him and calling the chief and basically saying, you know, you can't prosecute me. I'm the prosecutor. I'm not going to prosecute myself. And she has apologized, but it was a pretty brazen anti-cop rant. And the Republican Party locally has come out and said, well, they're defending her, not necessarily the officer, although they haven't criticized the officer. But they've said that they think it's just Democrats trying to pile on politically and that the Democratic Party has not been supportive of law enforcement historically, that, you know, the local chair says bills like this one that we're going to talk about are just election year, you know, signaling of support for police. So I want to get your take on what this bill is about, but also the broader issue of this debate about, you know, who supports police and what that looks like.
So I think that narrative is very cynical and not accurate at all. I think that everyone cares deeply about public safety and are very grateful for law enforcement for the part they play in keeping our community safe, making sure criminals can be arrested, making sure our children can be safe walking to and from school, making sure gang violence doesn't result in the death of innocent people. So I've worked on a number of things that protect public safety, but also support law enforcement. Our gun trafficking bill, I wrote with the police commissioner of New York City at the time, Commissioner Kelly, which gives law enforcement the tools they needed to go across state lines to catch these gun traffickers who are basically funneling weapons up the iron pipeline and selling them directly to gang members and other criminals, which just wreaks havoc in our communities, results in innocent people dying, like Nyasia Pryor Yard, a 17-year-old girl who was hit by a stray bullet right before she was going to be graduating and going off to UPenn. She was a life that was lost, that was needless, and so we wrote that bill in her name, and we got that passed last year. We care deeply about what's happening with mental health in this state, in this country. Post-COVID, a lot of our young people did not do well. Nobody did well, but our young people were really harmed. And so you'll see petty crime being committed by 14-year-olds, you know, trying to knock off a corner store.
Or steal a car, yeah.
Or steal a car, or, you know, steal all the bikes in a neighborhood. I mean, the type of crime you're seeing in every kind of neighborhood is being done by 14, 15, and 16-year-old kids because they don't have the normal mental stability that they would need to make better decisions. And they are misled and they are easily taken on by these gangs, and it's terrible. So Democrats care deeply about mental health, care deeply about public safety, care deeply about our law enforcement, our EMTs, our police officers, our firefighters who keep us safe every day. We've also been suffering with the scourge of fentanyl, as you know, and so we passed a very powerful bill, the Fend Off Fentanyl Act, which names it as a national security priority, and it allows the government to take on the Mexican cartels that are sending the fentanyl into the United States and China, who keeps sending the precursors to Mexico to do that. So we now have resources, we have money, and we have the ability to go after it. So Democrats care deeply about public safety and the law enforcement teams that help us keep our community safe. One thing I'm working on right now, as you mentioned, was this child care. One of the reasons I've been working on child care for everybody, and we have a major bill to do that. But I realized by meeting with law enforcement that they're having a really tough time recruiting and retaining personnel, because these are really hard jobs and they put their lives on the line every day to protect our community. And one of the biggest challenges for young officers that are joining is they don't have access to childcare that meets the hours that they have to work. I mean, people have to go on duty at 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 5 a.m. There's no childcare centers open till about 7 or 8 a.m. So what do they do? What happens if their spouse is also in law enforcement, which happens all the time? So because a lot of people who care about public safety often make these public service commitments together. So I worked with Senator Tillis, who's a Republican, on this bipartisan bill. We are hoping that we can get a vote on it. What it does is provide grant funding for police departments or existing child care centers to just offer longer hours, to hire more personnel so that they can have it. And this will help everyone. So these are things that I did similarly for our military. Because they have the same ridiculous hours, we needed to make sure the child care centers on military bases were open 24/7. And so we got those provisions put in place in the defense bill a few years ago. So this is not a new problem. It's one that I'm realizing is really harming our public safety because they can't recruit or retain personnel because it's not possible to also have a family.
Last question for you. You mentioned Mexico. You mentioned fentanyl coming across the border. Obviously, the subject of the border and immigration has been very hot this year. Republicans blocked what looked like a bipartisan bill that some Republicans had helped create. And now President Biden this week has issued an executive order suspending the processing of most asylum claims at the southern border. I wonder if you support that.
I do. I think that President Biden has been working really hard to do something that is within his executive power to do, because he was hoping the Congress would do their job, which was fix the law. The law is so deeply broken. We allow people to come to this country who are seeking asylum. That's what our law says. We think if you're being tortured in your home country, or you have horrific, you know, cyclones, or, you know, earthquakes, or if you have a government that is fallen. Like, these are reasons we allow people to come to the United States. What's happening now is that everyone's saying asylum, regardless of what actually their life is like. And we don't have the lawyers or the judges enough to adjudicate these cases quickly. They're taking 3, 4, 5 years. They need to take 2, 3, 4 months. And so all of our bipartisan legislation would have done that so that we could adjudicate this. I've heard estimates that in New York, 150,000 migrants that have come, 2/3 wouldn't qualify for asylum. They'd be sent home. We also need to give the ability of governors to issue emergency work visas. Like, people need to be working. If they're here waiting for their claim to be adjudicated, they should be working, paying their own bills, paying their own way. And the bill would have had that too. So what Biden is trying to do at this point is just stop the flow. I hope he offers additional executive orders. I would hope that he would offer emergency work visas for governors who want to implement it. I hope he would surge lawyers and judges. I would hope he would do as much as he could that would have been in that bipartisan bill if Congress had done their job and try to do it. There's no legal basis for him to do those things, but he can try through emergency action or executive order. He'll likely get sued and he'll probably lose in court. But I support him trying because there's nothing else to do if Congress won't do their job.
Senator, thank you for making time for us as always.
Thank you.
That is Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Want to say again, we are live this afternoon, but that conversation was recorded just about an hour ago. The senator was not able to join us during the live portion of the program, which is always our goal, but sometimes you take what you can get. We're also reaching out, and we have reached out, to Senator Gillibrand's opponent in her campaign for re-election, but we have not heard back from that campaign. That is an open invitation. If candidates are on the ballot, we want them on this program, ideally together. But again, sometimes you make accommodations because you want to make sure that you bring the voices of people who want to run for office to listeners. So that is Senator Gillibrand. I thought it was interesting, that last comment there. She is in favor of President Biden using executive orders to do things that are probably illegal but needed in her mind. And she thinks Congress has abrogated its duty on the southern border. That's how serious the situation is there. She says the president will probably lose in court. Should do it anyway. Interesting there. There's a lot there. We will archive our these various conversations, and you can find them at wxxinews.org/connections.